To turn to the book of Nehemiah. And I'll start with the final verse of chapter 9 and read through chapter 10. Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 38. And because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it, and our princes, Levites, and priests seal unto it. Now those that were sealed were, and through verse 27 it lists 84 names. Verse 28. And the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the porters, the singers, the Nathanmans, and all they that had separated themselves from the people of the lands unto the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone having knowledge and having understanding, they clave to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and into an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and to do all the commandments of the Lord our God, and his judgments and his statutes, and that we would not give our daughters unto the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. And if we, and if the people of the land bring ware or any victuals on the Sabbath day to sell, that we would not buy it of them on the Sabbath or on the holy day, and that we would leave the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. Also, we made ordinances for us to charge ourselves yearly with the third part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God, for the showbread and for the continual meat offering and for the continual burnt offering of the Sabbaths, of the new moons, for the set feasts and for the holy things and for the sin offering to make an atonement for Israel and for all the work of the house of our God. And we cast the lot among the priests, the Levites, and the people for the wood offering to bring it into the house of our God, after the houses of our fathers at times appointed year by year to burn upon the altar of the Lord our God, as it is written in the law, and to bring the first fruits of our ground and the first fruits of all fruit of all trees year by year unto the house of the Lord. Also the firstborn of our sons and our cattle, as it is written in the law, and the firstlings of our herd and of our flocks, to bring the house of our God unto the priests that minister in the house of our God, and that we should bring the first fruits of our dough and our offering and the fruit of all manner of trees, of wine and of oil unto the priests, to the chambers of the house of our God, and the tithes of our ground unto the Levites, and the same Levites might have the tithes in all the cities of our tillage, and the priests, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites take tithes, and the Levites shall bring up the tithe of the tithes unto the house of our God, to the chambers, into the treasure house. For the children of Israel and the children of Levi shall bring the offering of the corn and of the new wine and the oil unto the chambers, which are the vessels of the sanctuary, and the priests that minister, and the porters and the singers, and we will not forsake the house of our God. I've read through the end of the chapter. Let us bow for prayer. In the prophet Nehemiah's time, there's been a return from captivity of the children of Israel. King Darius of Persia has allowed those who want to return to their homelands, and has even given them some of the relics that were taken by Babylon when they were put in captivity, and has financed the rebuilding of the temple, an extremely generous move for a dictator, especially during that time period. So now the city of Jerusalem has been restored, it's been refortified, the temple has been rebuilt, the law has been read to the people. They've stood for hours listening and taking it in. And now they're agreeing to obey, as Brother Robert said in his prayer, they're entering a covenant. And so the names of those who are priests, Levites, who are civic leaders, are mentioned in the first 27 verses of chapter 10. Those people are not only verbally making that covenant, they are putting their names down, written in stone, so to speak. And these individuals, they probably could never conceive that some 2,000 odd years later in Copley, Ohio, that their names would be spoken of. But they've put it down for every generation to see. And that's something that we could ask ourselves. Would we want our name etched for all generations to see in the covenant that we've made with our God? Do we have that depth of faith? Do we have that desire, that thirst to obey as these individuals did in Nehemiah's time? And they're agreeing as their city is about to be reformed. They are about to start having a functioning government. They're going to be doing business. They're going to have an economy, obviously. They're going to start to get into a routine, but they want to set the basis. They want it to start off grounded firmly in accordance with God's will. And aside from those names that are listed, the rest of the people there, the other religious leaders, those who are taking it upon themselves to become singers and leading of the praise and worship, they all enter into this covenant as well. And they agree to separate themselves from the people and the lands around them. They're returning, and during this time, foreigners have moved into the land that was once theirs. They're mingling together. But part of this covenant they make is that they're going to keep themselves separate. They're not going to allow their daughters to marry people from these foreign tribes. They're not going to give their sons in marriage. And we can see so many examples time and time again when you go through the kings, how so many of them, their downfall was that they took foreign wives. And when they did that, they slid away gradually. They started to bring together the customs from their wives' religions into their own worship practices until eventually it became unrecognizable from what it had started at. And it just was a gradual. It wasn't all at once. It was day by day, just a little bit more. And so they make this covenant that they're going to stay separate. And then they're also promising to recognize the sanctity of the Sabbath day. They're going to keep it a day of rest. And they're not going to conduct business. And they also acknowledge, again, there are others amongst them who are foreigners who are going to try to open up their booths, their stores, whatever form of commerce they had, and try to sell on the Sabbath. And they're pledging, we're not going to not only conduct our business, we're not going to partake in their business. And that's a challenge we face to this very day. There in our country, it is still legal for a state to order that non-essential businesses be closed on Sunday. The Supreme Court has ruled while it's a religiously based concept, it provides a secular benefit in that everybody can enjoy a day off. And I know that the Jewish Sabbath and the Christian Sunday are not the same thing, but the principle behind it is the same. And if we aren't able to resist that temptation, if it's not something we absolutely need to get through the day, if it's not the food we need to eat, if it's not the gas we need to get home, we need to question ourselves, what is our motivation here? And it's not just, you can say, Brother Samuel, you're sounding pretty legalistic on this one. And it's not only from the perspective of what it does to us, but think of the countless people who are standing behind a counter on a day, perhaps during their formative teenage years, when they should be forming bonds with family and friends, and they are working in a job on a Sunday afternoon because the demand speaks for itself. People want to buy it, so we're going to be open to meet that demand. And if we close, then we lose because everybody else stays open. And it's become a very sad fact of our society that those who work in those jobs, there's no such thing as a weekend anymore. In fact, the weekend is probably the busiest time. And it just slides 7 days. There's no transition, 1 week to the next. It just goes on in a cyclical pattern with no break. And that is not God's will and desire for anybody, us especially as Christians. He clearly has laid out in both the Old Testament and the New Testament that there is to be a day of rest. There's to be a break from business. There's to be a day off from the cares and concerns of this world. And in the remaining portion of the chapter, they dedicate themselves, they make the oath that they are going to care for the upkeep of the temple and for those who work in the various jobs in the temple. They're going to give a third part of a shekel to purchase the things that are needed, the showbread, the sacrifices that are made on a daily basis, which is a very large amount of animal sacrifices. And they cast lots to see who would provide the wood offering at the appointed times of the year to burn on the altars. And they promise whatever if they're raising livestock, if they're raising crops, if they're growing fruit, that they're going to give the first to the service of the Lord. And when one pledges to give their first, they're putting their faith in God that He's going to provide. Because after the first, there's no guarantee of a second, a third, a fourth. There's no guarantee that the cow will give birth to more than one offspring after that. So to pledge the first of anything is taking a leap of faith. They're signifying their willingness to put their trust in God, not to store up what they need and then give to the Lord and to the house of God's service. They're saying we're going to give to the Lord first and then trust that He will provide after that. And whatever we're in, very few of us are agriculturally dependent for our livelihoods, but whatever we're working in, we can make this applicable. Think about, do we trust God? Do we really do that? Or do we try to make sure we've got our nest egg, our our safety net, so to speak, together. And then, if there's anything extra, that gets donated, or that goes to help the less fortunate. And it's different for each and every one of us. Brothers, sisters, it's for us to examine our hearts. There's no hard answer and fast answer for this. But each and every one of us, as they did in this time, we have to examine where we are and where our trust is. And there's a restored faith in this chapter, a restored hope, a restored people who are pledging, promising their God that their service to Him is first and foremost in their lives. And they also promise to cancel debts. They promise that they are going to remember the seventh year when all debts are to be forgiven. And can we imagine what our society would look like if that happened? How different banking would look. How different we might look upon somebody we do a service for, or somebody we lend our time or our money to, if knowing that every seventh year debts are forgiven. It would take a lot of humility. It would take definitely more patience than I know I myself have. It would take a great spirit of forgiveness. And if you think about what they're promising and what keeping this means, collectively, in today's dollars, it might be in the billions that they're going to lose out on by keeping this covenant. It's incredible that a people who just years before returned from being prisoners of a brutal king, who are just probably getting back on their feet, who are starting to enjoy some perhaps ease of luxury that an entire generation never knew, that some people were born and died never having a taste of. And they are listening to the priests and the prophets and those who are giving the commandments of God. And they're sincerely desiring to start out on the right foot with a spirit of humility, with a spirit of servitude, with a spirit of gratefulness for what God has done for them. And this afternoon hour, let's ask ourselves those same questions. This covenant that was made, if it was presented to us, would we enter into it? Would we be able to adapt our lives in this way? Would we be able to look upon our brother and our sister in the same spirit, knowing that this is going to affect every single aspect of our life and our children's lives and their children's lives? We see how things compound generationally, how wealth can flow and how it can have so much of an impact for generations to come. But these people know what's the importance of the true legacy of a godly life. It's not about what they can provide financially for their children or for subsequent generations or how comfortable or how easy they can make it for them. They're showing that the importance is showing them true servitude, a true heart that seeks after the will of their God. Amen.